Robots Radio. Games. Lore. Stories. Community. Just press play.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Robots Radio presents...
Listening to the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast, the best way for everyone from experienced dungeon masters to those curious about D&D to learn more about the worlds, creatures, and lore of Dungeons & Dragons.
Sergio.
Crit?
Do you know what today is?
Today? Why, it's Christmas Day.
Is it really? It's, hold on.
No, wait, no, I'm confused. What day is it?
I don't know. We've been in this tower for so long.
Time works a little differently in this tower. Not sure what day it is. I'm not sure when's the last time I bathed. Not sure a lot of things anymore.
You haven't been bathing?
Sure I have.
Well, Sergio, I thought it's time for us to take a field trip. And I have been... diving into my own homebrew spells, and I think I have a way for both of us to take a field trip out of this tower.
I thought we couldn't both leave. I thought one of us had to stay.
But that's the beauty of homebrew. I get to change the rules.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Would you like to take a field trip with me?
Sure, of course.
Portal! Look at that beautiful thing.
I'm not walking into that.
Oh, you've got to. Or I'm going to shove you.
Okay. All right, fine. Whatever. Let's go. Let's do this. I'm ready.
All right. Let's go. Welcome to my wonderful homebrew world, Alteris.
This is lovely.
You'd say this that. You would say that.
I mean, I don't want to hurt your feelings. It looks like a very nice homebrew campaign setting.
It needs a little work, but that's why we're here. We're going to talk about all things homebrew today, and I'm so excited.
You've built up quite the reputation as a sort of a homebrew king, if not at least a homebrew prince.
I would say prince.
As the kids these days say, homebrew is your vibe.
Most definitely. And as it is my vibe, I want to talk to you about some of my wonderful settings.
Let's hear it.
So the first thing that comes into mind as we walk through the beautiful fields here is the cities. The beautiful, beautiful, lush, and wondrous cities. And in my homebrew world, we have a fantastic city known as Citadel City. And in this city, there is an arena, a war pit, a brutal fisticuffs, if you will, that you can fight in for money.
Okay, I like that.
It is completely volunteer basis.
Oh, so there's like no... because I know like traditionally in arenas... there's there's a lot of slavery, like, you know, like people that are forced to fight or not even forced, but just sort of thrown in to as sort of like sacrifices. So this is completely volunteer basis. So
it is not 100% volunteer basis.
Nah, not 100%.
No,
close enough.
Our convicted serious criminals are forced to fight into this, but
can they win their freedom?
They can win their freedom amongst other prizes, sometimes incredibly dangerous prizes.
That seems a little problematic to have like a violent criminal win their freedom through more violence.
You would think so, but that's what we're going to talk about today. Working out the kinks and environments. So let's get down to the nitty gritties. Citadel City is an entire city that is based off of, its economy is based off of this fighting pit. Okay. The city has been completely constructed around it. There are taverns. There are bedding areas. There are inns, if you will. The city is just completely built around it. However, there's one structure in this city that keeps people perplexed, which is a museum. Now, why in the world would there be a museum here? Well, that comes down to who owns and operates the city. The city is owned and operated actually by a deity who is a dragon.
Interesting.
Yes.
Very cool.
The dragon constructed this entire city with one thought in mind: to get his hands on as much magical items and materials as he possibly could to keep it away from people, because he thinks people are dangerous. As he's the god of magi, that's his whole objective, to keep the dangerous magics away from people. What better way to keep them away from people than to make them believe it's right in front of them the whole time?
Okay, I'm digging this.
So we have the museum that has replica artifacts. People can research, they can begin to understand and learn why these items were kept away from them. But that brings us to the arena. Why in the world would we offer freedom to convicted, terrible criminals? And why in the world would you give them dangerous items? Well, this isn't 100% the truth. The deity in question is named Byros. The dragon deity, or Abaros, the blue dragon. The reason he gives these items and these fantastic prizes of freedom to these criminals is because they aren't truly free. Once they obtain their freedom, or said magical item or powerful thing, he then adopts them into his army and rehabilitates them.
Okay. I'm following you.
So it's not so much a risk anymore. And the people of the city understand that. And even the criminals understand that. When they fight for their freedom to obtain a sense of rebirth. And see, that's what makes this setting, to me, beautiful, because it was constructed in a way that the entire city nets together.
Okay.
So that's kind of what we want to talk about today with Homebrew. How do we get to that level of complexity within just a simple city?
Yeah, that's just the one city on the entire continent of Altaris.
Exactly. And we have another one that's completely ran and operated by a group of seven knights called the Silvered Knights. They were anointed with power by a great ancient dragon, and they've been instructed and appointed to enforce the rules of good across the realm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is another complex city. It's one of the largest cities in Altaris. But how do we get to that level? Well, the first thing we have to understand is we have to start at our ground base, which is the why.
Why Homebrew?
Why Homebrew? That is the question on everybody's minds. Why do I want to use Homebrew?
Because, I mean, look, official Wizards of the Coast, D&D stuff, there is much of that. And a lot of it's great. A lot of it's fantastic. And by all means, if you use any of the pre-created campaign settings, races, items, no one's going to hold it against you. No one's going to hold it against you if you set your campaign in Eberron, or if you set, or if you run the Curse of Strahd exactly how it's written in the book. I mean, these things have been play tested for by many, many people to work out the kinks so that it works as well as possible. And granted, there's still some stuff to be tweaked and fixed as even as after these works are published. But the reason for homebrew is to make it that much more your own. I mean, in a game that is limited only by your imagination, why not create your own campaign settings? Why not create your own races, your own items? I mean, like just the things that are, I saw the most amazing spell on Facebook. It's called tub thumping.
What?
The spell is called tub thumping. And I'll go into detail when we talk about homebrew spells and items and stuff.
Yes, but just, I have to hear just, more about this.
Just to tease you about that. But no, it's and it's so much fun. Like I said, it only adds to the element of fun and the element of imagination. And like I say, like it's you can, and again, no one's going to criticize you for taking bits and pieces of stuff that's already created and making sort of like a mishmash and an allegation of a lot of different stuff to create your own, you know, setting, race, you know, item, mm-hmm. whatever it may be. I mean, this is, like I said, the make the game your own by all means.
And I'll even up you one. It's not about you making it your own, but it's about also allowing your players to make it their own. The immersion is so much grander for your players as the DM if they feel like they're impacting not only the story, but the world.
Exactly.
We've all played those world-ending campaigns, and those are fantastic. We saved the day, yay. But what if the smallest choice you made had the grandest impact on an entire economy? An entire city can come to crumble because you decided that you were going to change the prices in a local shop to lower, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever have you. And I've heard it said both ways. Well, I don't want to put homebrew in my campaigns because I feel it's going to take away from D&D. And, you know, I can see that to a point. You get too homebrewy and you get too epic and you get too fantastical. It does take away from the feel of life or death scenarios in D&D. But in that same point, if you're not adding just a little spice of homebrew, you're not doing yourself any justice. And it doesn't have to be incredible homebrew. I've had people do homebrew rules for the games. I've had people, natural 20s aren't natural 20s. You know,
house rules are so prevalent that they're included in the player's handbook, in the DM's handbook.
Yes.
Because every game is going to have its own house rule. Like a popular house rule that I've used is, especially in previous editions, when you had to confirm a critical hit. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, in fifth edition, you roll a 20 and that's a critical hit. You know, 3.5, you had to confirm it with another roll that at least meets or beats the AC. But if you rolled another 20, then that's, you know, that's not only confirmed, but you triple damage as opposed to whatever, you know, the damage may be. And then you get to roll a third time.
Yes.
And if that third roll is a 20, if you roll three 20s in a row, you will instantly kill whatever creature you are attacking.
Also, I'm checking your dice.
Also, those are loaded dice. I spent hours crafting this deity battle. Just the idea of being able to do something you're not really supposed to do. Mm-hmm. Like that's a criticism in video games, especially where you have like leveled, where like the creatures level along with you.
Yeah.
You never feel like you are like you're overmatched. And if you end up killing this creature that you've kind of, you know, done something great and amazing. That's something that is very much possible with D&D or with any tabletop role-playing game, because you can tweak the rules to your liking.
Exactly. So now that we've answered the why should we do it, now we have to answer
freaking
the
fun, man.
It's fun. Now we have to answer the how should we do it.
Well, that's tricky. It's easy to answer why. It's trickier to do how.
So here's what I'm gonna do. Okay, I'm gonna put it down. The building blocks of how we built Citadel City. So the first thing you have to do is start with a basic town or city. Okay, you don't have an emperor, you don't have a governor, you don't have anything. It's just a town where people shop, they live, it's normal daily life. Mm-hmm. We start there with our basic foundation, and now we need to spice it up. So to spice it up, we need somebody in charge. Now you have to decide, do you want this to be a prosperous city? Do you want it to be a city that's faltering and failing? Do you want it to be just a normal average city? What do you want? Who is going to lead this city? Is it going to be an entity, or is it going to be one physical person? Or maybe it's attached to a network. Choose who your leader of this city is, this mm-hmm. environment. Once you've chosen your leader, choose their impact. How have they impacted the town? What actions have they taken to impact this town or city? And once you've done that, you have your homebrew environment. It's just Citadel.
Yeah, you have the basic building blocks, mm-hmm. and then you can start to fill in all the crevices of the backstory of, you know, how did the city come to be? Like, you know, if you decide it has a duke that was put in charge by the emperor who's in, you know, the capital city, mm-hmm. you know, what is that duke's connection to the emperor? You know, are they friendly? Is he sort of a sycophant, or is he like possibly like, you know, trying to like angle himself as a usurper or an heir? You definitely want to start off with the big strokes, the big wide strokes, yep. the general ideas, like you said. And then that's when you can sort of like, you know, fill in the details.
Yeah.
You know, trying to do details first can be too overwhelming.
It always is.
And I find myself giving up. You want to start off with big general ideas and then work your way down.
Exactly. So now that we have our city, the next question we have is, what about the lore? How do we get any sort of backstory history here? Well, the answer is you don't always have to. Sometimes it's as simple as a wandering merchant wandered into a city. He saw that it was suffering. He provided his aid in merchandise and increased the wealth here. And they appointed him the governor or emperor or whatever of the duke, whatever you want to call it, of this city. Kick-ass duke. And there you go. That's the history. It literally took us all 5 seconds to explore. The lore behind whatever you're creating is as vast or as little as you want it to be. Don't try to lose yourself in these details, because that is where our players come in. Let them explore. Let them discover. Let them influence the environment, because that's where your lore for years to come is going to come from, is your players. Let them impact and change the world.
I was going to make that exact same point. There have been numerous occasions in a homebrew campaign or a homebrew setting where I left it specifically open-ended. I mean, I didn't let the players know this, but I let whatever detail specifically open-ended to be determined by whatever the players did.
Exactly.
So if the players did option A, well, then that means that this city was cursed by a witch 500 years ago. Mm-hmm. If the players chose option B, that means the city was founded by an exile nomad who, you know, threatened, vowed revenge on the empire. So, like I said, like that's very crucial. You don't necessarily have to have every single detail. You can planned out ahead of time.
Oh,
definitely,
yeah.
Like you said, definitely let the players mold and and create the world around them. Like, make them feel like they are responsible for changing this city, this continent, this world that they're in.
Oh, yeah. So now that we've answered our how, let's dive into what I made. Yay!
Now it's time for you to show off your shiny toys.
My shiny toys. No, we'll use Altaris as an example. So what I have is an entire world, but we're going to start with one simple continent. And the main continent to Altaris is one of the most historical and shares some of the most just downright juicy lore across the realms. So the history with this one, Elsfeth, is that long ago there was a grand battle in the Forgotten Realms between a man who was cursed with lycanthropy and an ancient deity. The man with lycanthropy was set to slumber for all of eternity. His power was so grand and great that he imagined an entire world. A traveling being known as Univerus came upon this dream and loved the world so much that they birthed it into existence. Yes.
Okay, that's wild. Okay.
It is. Well, Univerus, we'll get into that when we talk about deities, but after Univerus birthed it into existence, they decided that they needed a commanding authority over it, as there are no deities over this world, and they don't want the old deities to take control. They've right. seen the impact of the warring gods upon many a worlds, and they do not want what they're trying to achieve on this planet is peace and prosperity.
Right, right.
So they scoured the universe for separate races and found them, but not before the great dragons Bahamut and Tiamat found the world first. There was a great war of the dragons, which paved a lot of the landmass into what it is today. After the war of the dragons moved on, Univerus started to bring forth different species and races into this world and gave one instruction, and one instruction only, is to live amongst each other in peace. From there, they began to develop cities. The dwarves built great and beautiful cities in the sides of mountains, one of which still stands today, which is Winterforge. The elves built their homes in the woodlands and amongst the plains. The humans built their cities in small townskeeps in the desert wastes and along the coasts. All of these races began to develop their world. Then there was a great war of segregation amongst the races. The more humanoid creatures did not think that they did not trust the more monstrous races that were brought to this world. And the monstrous races were condemned to another continent, which we won't go into. But from there, it developed further, where deities began to be born through action.
But now you have this lore set up that on this other continent.
Yes.
That, you know, it's essentially the monster in the bed or under the bed or the monster in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
There's this other continent that's full of fearsome, deadly creatures.
Yes. But again,
is it true? Is it just something that people tell kids to scare them?
Exactly.
Or we'll ship you off to, continent.
And that is actually one of the adventures that my party has gone on, is to discover what the truth of this continent is. In reality, what it was is the humanoids had sentenced these races over to this other continent out of fear, because of what they knew from their previous lives, from the previous stories that were told amongst them among the other worlds, how the orcs would betray and ravage the lands and destroy them, and And what it caused was a great divide into the ideals of what Univerus wanted, which is where our gods had become born, because Univerus saw that it was happening again. So they gave birth to several deities that were mortals that proved themselves through action. They traveled the multiverse to find three people that could be appointed the abilities of time, fate, and destiny to intertwine and weave the history and the future of this world. So through all of that, we won't go into, but other grand things happened. But there's our base for Altaris. A grand event, a dark past, and a cause and effect for why the world was split the way it was. So yeah, let's dive into some of the more major cities. So we have one city called Winterforge, I mentioned briefly. It was originally a dwarven stronghold, but now the dwarves share it with Lycanthrope. It is an entire city built around Lycanthrope kind, and the dwarves reside in the mountains of that city now. The castle that the dwarves had originally built was built into the side of a city, the dwarves built into the side of a mountain, not a city. There was a huge war between them and the elves at one point, which gave the Lycanthropes this abandoned kind of central point that they took over. Once they took it over, they found the dwarves were still living. The Lycanthropes of this world are not always hostile. So they worked with the dwarves and created this beautiful city where amazing things are created. Ice weapons, weapons created completely, crafted out of fire. They've created these magnificent armor and weapons and world sought out items. So that's Winterforge. Mm-hmm. It is one of the most fantastical places for blacksmiths to acquire learning. Just on the other side of it, there is a place called Bad Call. Now, this is an encampment that was created in the Tundran Wastes that barbarians and fighters alike can live there almost in a Valhalla kind of state.
Okay.
They can constantly fight. They can war, drink to their delights, and then there is absolutely zero repercussions. If they die there, they're just reborn immediately, and they can go back to fighting. It is a heavenly state for people who lived there. However, to get in, you must appease the deity of chaos through action.
Nice, nice.
So that's Bad Call. It's a wonderful, destructive place. And the last place I want to talk about is Bagladernish. Okay. Originally, Bagladernish was a desert city that was well established, and it was beautiful. It was prosperous. It was wonderful. However, when a individual was given authority over this section of the continent, which we call the Compass Knights, when the Southern Compass Knight was given authority over here, they did nothing to help prosper or develop the area, which let siege to thieves and warmongers and villains alike, which caused the entire South to run into a state of decay. So now you have these large cities that once thriving mercantile areas are now areas where you may find mercenaries and thieves and rogues and the, shall we say, unsavory members of the community. But again, this was through the actions of a player. Because of their actions or their inaction, an entire section of a continent has now been reduced to crime.
It's a bit lawless. It's a bit, post-apocalyptic sort of not in environmental sense, but in sort of the societal sense.
Yeah.
I love you know, you're describing the different cities in the campaign setting that you've created. And I love like the differences between them. Uh-huh. And I think that's crucial when you're developing a campaign setting, is to not have every city be a, you know, carbon copy of the previous.
Oh yeah.
You know, you have a city that is, like you were just mentioning, was sort of built by thieves and rogues and ne'er-do-wells. Mm-hmm. And now has become sort of like the place you look when you want to, you know, buy a weapon, no questions asked.
Yeah. Yeah. It's they've created this wonderful community.
But then you also have, you know, a city that is, started off as an encampment and mm-hmm. was built into, you know, into an established, you know, stationary, you know, location.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I like the variety is really what is great whenever you're able to create your own campaign setting. You're literally able to have a little bit of everything.
Exactly. So now that we've hit some major plot points for settings, let's talk about creatures and races that we can throw into these settings. I talked briefly about some of the monsters and creatures that I have thrown in some of my settings. We've got lycanthropes. We've got barbarian, like four-armed barbarians. We've got all these fantastical creatures. But we have to decide where they belong. Because obviously we can't have orcs hanging out in a city full of people, can we?
Why not?
Exactly. It's homebrew.
Traditionally, orcs and even half orcs, like we've discussed that mm-hmm. In our previous episode, you know, because of their appearance, they're not welcomed all too well in any sort of community, whether it be human or dwarven or elven. And it's up to you whether you want to stick to that narrative, or if you want to muddy it up a little bit mm-hmm. and say like, well, like, you know, there's a couple of cities where orcs and half orcs are welcomed, but you know, the cities up north, not so much, you know, but starting to get toward the capital and further south, assuming the capital's in the middle, I'm going kind of by Oblivion, the Elder Scrolls Oblivion map, where the capital's like dead center in the map.
Yep.
You know, they're very much welcome. And even so, like, you know, some of them hold office, whatever you want to do, or you can mm-hmm. just completely upend it and say like, there's no prejudice whatsoever, you know, yep. Orcs, half orcs, you know, they mingle just as easily as any human or elf would.
Or you can throw it completely off the wayside and say that the humans live in the wilderness.
The humans are the worst.
Exactly, which is what I have on a separate continent, where humans are the worst and they live in segregation.
Nice.
And complete isolation. But that brings us to, okay, well, we've got these established races and that's fine. I want my own race. So some of the questions you have to ask yourself when you're making your own race is, what is the purpose of this race? Are you wanting to play a specific character? Do you want to see specific creatures walking around? What is it? What is the reason you want this race? Because your reasoning is what it's going to give you your drive to push it to the next level. So, for example, I have a race of vampires that are half-blood. So they're only half vampire. They were created, however, in an untraditional sense where they were experimented on. Vampires were experimented on, and the blood was extracted and given into orphans by a terrible, cruel duke. This gave birth to an entire race of half vampires, where they have to consume blood that has adrenaline in it in order to survive. The whole process with how they were created was they were created with adrenaline and everything else. But yes, so that is the reason. That is one of the races that I've created. And they're called vampirids. The reason I created them was for essentially a superior defense force in Citadel City, because they are actually employed by Byros the Grand Dragon as guards on the night shift.
I mean, makes sense. Yeah, I mean, and yeah, like you created a race to to fill a need.
Exactly.
You know, the need being we need elite guards that that are awake at night, you know, that are stronger than humans. In fact, you know, are better suited to guard at night.
Exactly.
And so when creating a race, like you can do it for various different reasons. One is to like you did, fill a need. Two is to sort of flavor up the campaign, the story. You know, there's you could create, like, you know, we've talked about different like sub races.
Yep.
You know, elven sub races. You know, there's the mer folk. You know, they're pretty much like, you know, merman elves. They're aquatic elves that, you know, were created because, like, well, hey, like, what if there were elves in the water? Like, what about that? And that those sort of questions is what, you know, what precipitate race creating.
So exactly.
You can say, like, okay, well, what if, you know, what if a human, you know, what if orcs were traveling in a tribe and came across a baby that was left behind for whatever reason. And that baby grew up as an orc, you know, obviously, like, knew it didn't really look like an orc, you know, obviously, but in every way but appearance was an orc.
Mm-hmm.
You know, married an orc and had a half-orc child. And, you know, that orc, because knowing, like, you know, story of his father, goes on to do whatever, mates with a dwarf. And, you know, all of a sudden then you have, you know, all sorts of possibilities open for,
oh yeah,
for races you want to create.
Yep. And that is the spiral effect, as I call it. You fill a need, or you have a character who has this incredible backstory. It's the spiral effect. One action can result in an entirely different race. And it's incredible. And honestly, I find that's the easiest way to create an entire race, is to find a spiral effect. Okay, we have lycanthropes. Well, what if they couldn't cure their disease because they're special born? What if they were magically created this way at birth? That's who they are. What would happen if they mated with humans? Well, then you have half lycanthropes. Well, what would that be? We have this race in our world. They are wolf people. They share some similarities with a wolf or a tiger or whatever animal the lycanthrope was. They share some physical similarities to that. You know, they may have a tail. They may have claws and fangs. They may have just different colored eyes. But they share attributes of both races. And again, it was a spiral effect from a player. So it's a wonderful thing if you just let creativity roll. So I've got tons of races to talk about, but we're running out of time. So let's go.
I mean, yeah, that's the thing with homebrew is, like I said, it's only limited by our imagination. So we could literally talk about homebrew for hours, weeks on end. I mean, there's an entire website devoted to homebrew material that we talk about every single week that we love and support 100%.
Boom. And we're going to talk about that during the mid break. Sergio, we've talked so much about homebrew, and we find ourselves at the middle of the show.
Once again.
Once again.
As always.
it's coming to a better end. It's bittersweet.
It's all downhill from here.
So to start off our mid-break, I would like to thank our patrons, and we'll start with our apprentice patron. We have Daniel Pileo.
And Pileo.
Pileo, there we go. Sorry, I butcher names, and I'm sorry, I'm trying. So we have our scholars, Wolf the Sheepdog, Remington Cloutier. We have our wizards, Stagger and Stumble, Jonathan Sutter, and Jared Bush, and Chris Mitchell. And we have our deity patron, Lupus Malum. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And if you're interested in becoming one of our patrons, just go to patreon.com/DNB Lorecast. We have several different tiers to sign up for, starting as low as $5. You can get stickers, ad-free episodes, bonus episodes, t-shirts, one-on-one time or two-on-one time, whatever it may be, with me and Crit, where we will help you do exactly what we're talking about right here, which is like building a homebrew setting or building homebrew races. You can also be a part of our monthly patron game that we've started back up.
Yep.
And if you're in the $10 tier, you'll have access to those episodes as well, because those are included as bonus episodes. So, I mean, there's a lot of different stuff, a lot of cool swag you can get if you are so inclined to throw some gold our way. We would very much appreciate it. And if you can just listen, we appreciate that too.
And, you know, sharing with your friends is one of the best things you can do for us.
Sharing is caring. It's a rule now.
But again, thank you to our patrons. You're all wonderful. You allow us to do this every week. It's incredible the amount of support you show and the amount of love you show to us. We appreciate you. So, Sergio, that brings us to, drumroll please, the DM's Corner.
DM's Guild Corner. So I got this in my inbox just a few days ago, and I knew we were going to be talking about homebrew stuff, and literally like just about anything on the DM's Guild could constitute. Like I could bring it up. So I could just say dmsguild.com. That's what I'm bringing up for the DM's Guild Corner. But this came into my inbox a couple of days ago, and I was just fascinated by the amount of work and creativity that went into it. So most D&D players are familiar with Strahd the Vampire and his campaign, The Curse of Strahd. It's recently been updated to 5th edition. It's a classic. It's got vampires. It's gloom. It's one of D&D's most popular for a reason. What the Hedra group have done is essentially remixed it. They've Ooh. Remixed it and created something called One Night Strahd. Now, One Night Strahd is the Curse of Strahd campaign remixed and turned into either a shorter campaign, like a four hour sessions, or like one day long session that's you could do for a Twitch stream, a 12 hour Twitch stream while you're doing this campaign. It's precise and messy as a vampire bite. One Night Strahd delivers a spectacle and catastrophe of gothic horror as a consistent and fast-paced short campaign for D&D 5th edition. It condenses and remixes the 200-plus hour campaign of Curse of Strahd into a replayable adventure weighing in at 525 pages with over 200 illustrations, maps, and charts. With careful attention to the design of exploration, combat, and role-playing opportunities, our goal has been to make something for every DM and every table. After 3 years of extensive testing,
holy cow,
we're proud to share this explosive adventure with you. This, you know, even though this is something that stems that, you know, is essentially, you know, something that it's not, you know, 100% homebrew. You know, it obviously leans very heavily into, you know, on Curse of Strahd, the pre-existing, you know, Wizards of the Coast official, D&D official Curse of Strahd campaign. But the idea, the heart of homebrew is right there in this. And I came into my inbox just a couple of days ago. I haven't had a chance to dig into it, but just based on what I've seen already, it comes with such a hearty recommend. Like I said, it's everything that D&D is meant to be as far as, like, you know, fun and imaginative and, you know, you're able and so malleable at the same time.
Oh yeah.
You know, there's definite structure, but it allows you to, like, stretch your legs out and really, really figure out, like, what you want to do with the story. But yeah, like I said, you can run a roughly 16 hour version. So, four hour sessions, or as an event game, which runs roughly 12 hours. So, you know, it's replayable as well. So you can continue to, play it again and again, even with the same group. But yeah, like I said, I can't recommend it enough. We'll have a link to it in the show notes, and definitely check it out. It's only $19.93, which for something that's over 500 pages,
yeah,
you know, definitely worth your buck. And the three years of playtesting, I mean, that's something that you only really get with official content.
Mm-hmm. That sounds awesome. I'm here for it.
Absolutely. Like, I saw it, I'm like, seems interesting. I started reading into it. I'm like, add to cart. Thank you very much.
Right. So on that note, let's dive into the end of the show. That Willem scream. Love it. Anyway, so we've talked a lot about homebrew. We've talked about hows and whys. We've talked about wheres and whens. We've talked about races. We've talked about all these wonderful things. And now let's get to the good stuff. Let's talk about our spells and items. Sergio, I want to hear about this spell.
So this spell is called Tub Thumping. It's a reaction. And if you are knocked prone, as a reaction, you can get back up. You get knocked down, but you get up again. And you can only use it once per long rest. Ideally, you have to piss the night away before you can use the spell again. Like, granted, you know, this isn't going to be, you know, a world beater spell. This isn't going to be the difference maker when you're fighting Tiamat. You know, this, you're not going to, you know, pull out Tub Thumping and all of a sudden be able to, you know, kill Strahd. But it's fun. It's fun. Yes. It's, you know, it's, you know, it adds character and flair to the campaign. And that's, you know, that's a, for me, that's one of the highlights of homebrew, is to make the game, like I said, like your own, like you said, like the player's own. And it's just, it's a fun little spell.
It is. I like that. I love that.
It's called Tub Thumping. You get knocked down, but you get up again.
That's not what I was thinking it was going to, but I was like, you know what? I'm here for this. I'm loving this. Oh, goodness. Right. Well, I have brought not one, not two, but three magical items today.
You're an overachiever, as always.
In honor of our homebrew episode. And all three of these items have either been used by myself, created and used by me, or been created and used in one of my campaigns. So I will say they have been quite tested. Some of them seem broken until you get down to the nitty-gritties. So let's start off with our first one. Now, this one is an artifact level item. So this is, don't give this away unless you're ready to deal with it. This is an item called the Amulet of Vault. So with this item, it is a plain...
The Amulet of Vault?
Amulet of Vault.
Yes. Okay.
So this item appears as a standard just orange jewel hanging off of a plain black lace necklace. Okay. However, when the wielder or original creator, those are key words there, the wielder or original creator of this item says the word vault, an endless and completely, I will say, is huge, huge, an endless and enormous vault door will open up before them. In the vault, it will appear as if there is nothing. However, the wielder or the creator can place an item in the vault and it will be locked and secured forever.
Forever?
Forever, or until called upon again. Now, there are three key components to how to use this. We know the key word to open and close the door is vault. In order to access any items that have been placed in the vault, you must know the name of the item and say vault afterwards. The item will be presented to you. And the third detail is, in order to place an item in the vault, you must say vault and then the item's name. So, that being said, the only person who can pull anything out of these vaults is the person who wields the amulet. The only one who can put anything into these vaults is the person who wields the amulet. The item does not need to be physically placed in by that person, though. So, easy explanation. I have the necklace. I'm fighting Tiamat. I can back Tiamat into the vault and shut the door, as long as I say vault Tiamat.
Okay, so how do you get something out of the vault?
You have to say the item's name. In this case, it would be a Tiamat vault. So the item would or person would exit the vault.
So, very cool item.
Very broken, too.
I see it as the beginning of a, as like it's the plot hook.
It is. It's very
it's
much
something. It's something that's discovered, and the player is unwittingly says, the thing, the creature, the item, whatever it may be, out, thus bringing this, you know, unspeakable, like, eldritch horror into the world.
Yes. And currently, it is being wielded by a deity, and that is actually what it's used for. It is to lock away dangerous artifacts or creatures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, here's the problem. Everybody looks at this from the surface value, and they go, it's broken, because you can literally lock anything you want in there. However, the rules of the vault are simple. Anything that's locked in the vault is locked in a timeless state. So they don't age, they don't need to eat, they don't need to drink. There's no reason for them to do anything except exist in the vault. You also have, however, locked that said person in with potentially multiple dangerous items. Because when the vault is given to someone or they find it, it is always found in a state where there are items still left over from the previous owner.
Right, of course. Yeah.
So you have no idea what's in here. So it's not so much that it's broken, but like you said, it's more so a great plot hook for a DM.
Right, right. It's so, like the Phantom Zone,
yeah.
Or that like the big mechanism that the Ghostbusters kept all the ghosts in.
Exactly. It's a very dangerous, dangerous item. And it has come back to bite many a party members in the Keister. Because they've used it and they were like, oh, this is great. I can lock whatever I want in there. And then the big baddie gets a hold of the big baddie weapon and then it's game over. So there's item number one, the amulet of vault.
The ecto containment system. Had to look that up because it was going to bug me if
I couldn't
remember the name of it.
And you can tinker with these things. You don't have to use them as they are.
Yeah. I mean, that's, and again, that's the thing about homebrew is, this could be a one-time use item that, like eons ago, the deities, the cosmology of gods, came together, put a little bit of their own power mm-hmm. into crafting, into creating this artifact to contain this, you know, this horror that would end up destroying not only the world, but the universe, the cosmos, and then hit it, hoping to, that it would never be found again, only for it to be found.
Of course.
And again, like, you know, like some Pippin style character from Lord of the Rings, is responsible for unleashing that horror. And exactly. then once it's unleashed, the amulet, the artifact is destroyed, and they have to mm-hmm. figure out a way to not if to either destroy this horror or another way to like maybe petition the gods to once again create it. And then, you know, that's, you know, it's that, man, I'm thinking of a campaign already, like just trying to, I've got myself raring to go.
The
brain squirrel's running in the
ready
circle.
To do this. Yeah. Right. So let's jump into item number two. So item number two is it's a lower kind of classed weapon. Though fantastical, it is still not as impressive as the vault. This is the blade of the Wolf's Fang. Now, this is a long sword, and it's incredible because it is forged. It is a long sword that is forged out of the horn of a golden dragon. The bone, or the blade itself is retractable. So as it is carried on your hip, it looks like a horn of a dragon. When used, the blade can be extracted and used as a sword. Now, what makes this blade incredible is that you can blow into the horn itself and create this odd sound and summon wolves within a 10-mile radius to be commanded by you. In addition...
All right. I like that. I like the idea of... especially if it has like something to do with the character's like backstory.
It does. It does.
Yeah.
The original wielder of this weapon was actually a werewolf. So that being said, in addition to being able to summon wolves, you can also use the blade itself deals additional ice damage, as the original wielder of this was a grand white wolf from the Tundran Wastes. So the weapon itself will do an additional 2d6 cold damage upon anybody it's used on.
I like the idea that, you know, it calls the wolves, it does damage. You know, is there any sort of negative consequence to it? Because that, you know, I like, you know, and I don't want, not necessarily everything has to have mm-hmm. like a sort of give and take. You know, some things can just be badass for the sake of being badass. but I know, like, you're a fan of, you know, like gives there always being like some negative consequence to wielding a powerful magical item.
I'm glad you asked, because that brings us to the negative consequence. And it's not a very big one, because it's not a very powerful weapon. And realistically, this is one of those weapons that could get away with not having one. But for flavor, you have a one...
And we are all about our flavor.
We are. You have a 1% chance. So it's not very big, but you have a 1% chance of an evil wolf or wolf-like entity being summoned and you having to do battle with it.
I like that. It's not, and it's something that you, as a DM, can mm-hmm. allude to, can like hint at.
Yep.
And so every time it's used, I would assume that the DM would roll the D100.
Yes.
And based on, you know, whatever, if, you know, whatever number it is that you have to roll, based on the proximity. So let's say it's 50, that if the player uses this item and a 50 is rolled, let's say the D100 rolls a 42. As DM, you could say, like, you use the item, but you sense like a darkness like sort of overtaking you. If it's like, if it's like a one or two, if it's as far as if it's far away from the predetermined number, you know, you might not even allude to it at all. But the closer it is, you want, like, I think, yeah, that adds a lot of flavor to it. I like that.
Yeah, is exactly why I added it on there. But yeah, so this is item number two, which brings us to our final item of the wonderful episode that we've had. I've had a good time on this episode.
I mean, I'll never apologize for talking about ways to make your D&D campaign, your D&D never. Game more fun.
Never.
Ever.
It's not going to happen. So item number three is a special item. We don't do a lot of weapons on here, so I actually decided we're going to do two weapons this episode. So this item starts off as a dagger. This is the Dagger of the Phoenix. Okay. So the way this weapon is wielded is it does 4d6 fire damage when wielded. However, after 5 uses of positive hits, okay, so if you've actually hit your target and dealt damage, after 5 times, the weapon explodes into a burst of flame and is reduced to a pile of ash on the floor. After 1d4 plus 1 turns, it is then reborn as the nearest weapon in your hand.
Interesting. Okay.
And again, the cycle repeats. So after 5 hits with this weapon, it bursts into flames, and 1d4 turns plus 1 turns, it is reborn in a weapon again. Now, this can become...
What's this called again?
This is the Blade of the Phoenix.
The Blade of the Phoenix. Mm-hmm. Okay. A very appropriate name.
Yes. So this can be detrimental. This has no negative consequences because this can be detrimental just as much as it can be beneficiary. Because let's think about it this way. Let's say one of your party members carries a greatsword. Well, that's fantastic if you can wield the greatsword. But what if you are fighting in a party of nothing but spellcasters? And your opponent has a sword the size of a house.
Yeah.
So you're using this weapon, you get your 5 hits, and it bursts into flames. And then, let's say one turn later, it turns into this ginormous blade that you cannot wield.
True.
At that point, your weapon is completely useless. So it's up to the party member who uses this weapon to be smart enough to carry additional weapons on them. But that also comes with a consequence of now you could become over encumbered. You could have too much weight. So really no reason to add negative consequences to this blade because yes, the fire damage is powerful, but it comes with its major downside.
Yeah. And I'm not one to really micromanage the weight that a player carries. But at the same time, like, bro, you're not walking around with 4 great swords. Like, that's just not going to happen. Like, I mean,
there's no way.
Like, you have like a great sword, maybe some daggers, and then like everything else. But, you know, like, I'm not going to get into the minutiae. Like, well, you're actually 2.5 pounds over encumbered. So yeah. I'm going to need you. But yeah, like, again, but you're also not going to be walking around with a damn armory on your back.
No, exactly. And that's my point is, you know, I don't manage weight like that either. But there's no way you're going to be carrying around armory around your back. There's just no physical way. But alas, those are our three items.
Alas, poor Yorick. This episode is dead.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's homebrew episode.
If you folks out there play your games and add homebrew items, spells, creatures, races, campaign settings, whatever it may be, please let us know. Email us, dndlorecast@gmail.com. Tweet at us, @dndlorecast. Join the Robots Radio Discord. We've got a channel on there that's super on and popping. Like, we are constantly talking on there. Let us know all the cool stuff that you've created.
Yes, please do. Because, hey, who knows? Your item may be featured on the next episode.
No, yeah, absolutely. So far, all these are coming from the dark recesses of Crit's mind, which is not a safe place to be. So we would rather venture forth into, you know, into terrains more lovely and bright.
I mean, you see the world that I've created, right?
Exactly. It's not nice. It's not cool.
Well, it's time for us to get back to our safe tower. But before we go, Sergio, do you have anything to share with our lovely fans?
Well, you know, aside from, you know, you're able to email us, dndlorecast@gmail.com. You're able to tweet at us at dndlorecast on Twitter. You're able to join the Robots Radio Discord. We provide links to all those online places. And they don't really exist in the traditional sense, but they exist in our hearts and in our minds and on our computers and in Mark Zuckerberg's internet. You can find us all there. Please, you know, interact with us. Mm-hmm. We're always happy to talk D&D with just about anyone.
Oh yeah.
For me personally, I also co-host a podcast called Fandom University. We just released our second part. We go in arcs. We go for a few episodes at a time. We'll talk about different subjects. We've done the Aliens movies. We've done Resident Evil. We've done the comic book writer Grant Morrison, and we just finished up with Eternals. We talked about the comic books and the movie that just came out. We're taking a Christmas break, a holiday break. We'll be back at the beginning of next year. But in the meantime, we've got, you know, about 20 episodes up that you can listen to, and very proud of it. Very, very proud of what me and my co-host Sean Hamill, the writer of A Cosmology of Monsters, have created.
It's wonderful.
Thank you.
It's fantastic. It's wonderful. If you aren't listening, you should go check it out. I had some mic problems there. I couldn't unmute my mic. Anyway, so yeah, if you aren't listening to Sergio's pod, go check it out, please. It's a wonderful listen. I'm really enjoying the Eternals arc you guys are doing right now. I really thoroughly enjoyed the, well, you already done it. You've already done the Eternals arc.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've already done it. It's where I'm at right now in the show. But I really enjoyed the Resident Evil dive you guys did. That was extremely informative. It was great. So yeah, go check it out. It's a wonderful pod. On my end, on my bajillion pods. So we have.
If you ever form a podcast network, that's what it should be called. A bajillion pods.
Bajillion pods. So I'm just going to go in alphabetical order here. We have Avatar Journey of the Elements, TTRPG. It is a Avatar Legends based game. We have Call of Cthulhu Mythos Mysteries, 7th edition live play. We have Cyberpunked. That's Cyberpunk apostrophe D. That is our Cyberpunk Red live play. We have one of our newer shows, the Delta Green SCP Files, where we dive into the Delta Green system and play a live play using SCPs as the wonderful enemies. We have the Fumbling Four and the Almighty Crit R5E Homebrew live play podcast. You can hear a bunch of wonderful items and ridiculous pedantics over there. We also have our newest show releasing on the 30th of this month, The Knights of Darkness, which is a show where you're doing the live plays of all of the World of Darkness TTRPGs, starting with none other than Vampire the Masquerade.
Love it. Love me some World of Darkness.
Oh, yes. And the last one we have is Resident Evil Lorecast. And it is set up similar to this one. You can go check it out. It's all about Resident Evil.
The video games, you guys are going to be diving into the movies pretty soon.
Yep. We're trying to stay in canon order at the moment. Yep. And it's really hard because after you get at a certain point, it starts to go from canon, non-canon. Oh, this mission is canon, but the rest of the game's not. So
right.
We're trying to link it all together for all of our fans that are listening to understand and familiarize themselves with the storyline.
Like the timeline.
Yeah, the timeline. And we are actually going to do our first Patreon exclusive episode. We're going to go watch the new movie coming out next week.
I can't wait.
We're excited. Wait. We're going to go watch it, and then we're going to give our comments about it on our Patreon pod.
Nice. Excellent.
So, but yeah. So that's all I got going on. And if you want to chat.
That's it. That's all.
That's it. Yeah, that's no biggie. Like Sergio said, if you want to chat with us and hang out with us, you can check out all those shows. Sergio show and our Dungeons & Dragons Lurecast show on Spotify and all the places. You can hit us up on our Discord, chat with us, and you know, feel free to reach out to us. We love to hear from you guys, and we love to hear the wonderful things you guys are doing. So
absolutely.
On that note, I think it's time for us to bid everyone adieu.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. If you've enjoyed the show, please consider sharing it with a friend, following us on Twitter at DNDLorecast, or jumping on the Robots Radio Discord to chat more with us about Dungeons & Dragons. We'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to a Robots Radio podcast. Smart shows for interesting people. Check out all the shows at robotsradio.net.